This is your moment. Your moment to move forward and make progress. It's time to see where an education can take you. For over 130 years, Strayer University has been at the forefront of change, offering programs that help students like you get ahead and stay ahead, so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.
Hey everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Zach on Film. I'm Zach Wolf. Across from me is Steven Schleicher.
Hello.
And rumbling across the internet is Rodrigo Lopez.
Oh, hey.
Hey, he's back. And of course, over there, Matthew Peterson.
I don't get to rumble? I don't.
No, you're just there.
Okay, that's cool, I suppose.
With the whole gang's back together.
Yeah, for, we're putting the band back together.
For a movie that is near and dear to our current location. And by our, I mean Steven and Zach's. Yeah. This week's, we are talking Paper Moon, mm-hmm. a movie that I just recently found out was filmed in the Hays, Kansas area.
2 weeks ago when we were talking about this.
Like,
what?
I mean, I found out through
work.
How do
you
know
that this is, you work for the Hays Visitors and Convention Bureau, and you didn't know that 1973's Paper Moon, starring Tatum and Ryan O'Neal, was shot here in the Hays, Kansas area?
Yeah, no. It had never been brought up in anything we'd ever discussed until, like, you had mentioned it before, and mm-hmm. then I started talking about it at work, like, oh, yeah, that movie, we all love it, it's great, we should find a VHS copy of it. And I go, have you heard of the internet? But yeah, so back in the 70s, mm-hmm. a movie was filmed here, and turns out pretty good. Pretty interesting.
It's actually a very, very good movie.
Yeah,
and it has been probably about, well, I don't know, 20 years since I saw it last. So mm-hmm. sitting down to watch this was a super treat, because I'd forgotten how the main thing that I always remember, and I probably think about this at least twice a month, mm-hmm. especially when I'm going through drive-thrus, and that is the money scam that they
do. Oh, yeah.
So for 20 years, I've been thinking about, oh, how does that scam work and how easy is it to distract someone? And I just never took it upon myself to go back and visit the movie again.
Yeah.
To really see how they did it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, watching that again was a real treat. But, you know, this is a movie that I've been thinking about on a very regular basis since I saw it, you know, 25 years ago, probably. I was still in high school when I saw it. So
really?
Yeah. Yep. It's been a while.
Matthew, had you ever seen Paper Moon before?
This movie actually holds a special place in my heart because I don't know if you know this, Zach, but when Steven and I were young, there were only like 3 television networks.
Right.
And I believe it was ABC used to do this thing where they would rotate these movies in and out. And I very clearly remember watching this movie and hearing the woman singing on each in and out bumper, the little "Only a Paper Moon."
Yeah, I think that was Channel 41, because I think I saw that as well.
It was a network. I'm almost certain it was a network, because it would have been right about the time there was a Paper Moon TV show.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, you know, we were very, very young. But yeah, I remember this and, of course, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory as well as movies that we saw on TV that I enjoyed when I was young. But I hadn't seen it in probably 10, 15 years.
Okay. Rodrigo, have you been familiar with Paper Moon?
I was, largely because I hadn't seen it before, but when I arrived in Kansas, it got talked up a lot. People were like, "Welcome to Hays. They shot a little bit of Paper Moon here."
Well, and the interesting thing is that was probably in around 2003, because that's when Hays was celebrating the 30th anniversary of the movie.
Right.
So that's probably why it had a lot of talk going on then.
Right. And I guess that's just why I was never told about Paper Moon, because I just came in a little bit too late and no one has decided to do another big celebration of Paper Moon since I've been here.
For someone who works for the Hays Visitors and Convention Bureau, you would think you could make a big to-do about this.
You know, it's slowly happening.
It's now past the 40th anniversary. You passed that.
It is. I wasn't working there. I'm gonna get absolved of that.
The 45th anniversary will be next year.
Yeah, right.
So you can do it.
And we currently have a very good relationship with the people who are running the Fox Theater,
yeah,
where, you know, the Paper Moon has been shown before.
Yeah, that the actually when Paper Moon debuted, because it was shot in and around this area, Peter Bogdanovich, who's the director on this, who we need to talk about.
Yeah.
They made sure that the Midwest premiere was in Hayes, Kansas, and the theater was completely sold out. I mean, over 900 seats were in the theater at the time. And nobody else could get tickets. There were, you know, people milling around in the streets, mm-hmm. Waiting for the movie to get out so that they could, you know, wave at the actors and actresses and everybody that was here. So it was a big deal. Now, it's not without its controversy either, because according to one story, and I don't know if this was in Bogdanovich's book or someone else's book, but they said during the production, it caused a lot of conflict with people that were dating in Hayes, because all of the women wanted to be hanging around those people from Hollywood.
No.
And all of the Hayseeds were getting kind of angry. So it got very interesting. In fact, they stayed at the Holiday Inn, which has just in the last year been being torn down.
Uh-huh.
So by the time people hear this, it'll be completely gone.
We hope.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
One of the things that they did when the Holiday Inn, when everyone was leaving, it said, "Thank you for sleeping with us, Paper Moon." So it was basically kind of not only a dig on some of the shenanigans that were going on and causing romantic conflicts, but mm-hmm. also because that's where they stayed, was at that Holiday Inn mm-hmm. Back in the 70s. So there you go.
That's a little more wonderful
knowledge that you can
wow.
add to your ticket.
I feel as if Hayes has finally made its mark on the map. Forget all the rest of the history.
Oh, we had the Wild Bill Hickok.
Forget everything else. We had a movie film here for a short period of time in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So, Stephen, you wanted to talk about the director whose name I cannot pronounce.
So Peter Bogdanovich is kind of one of these really interesting directors that have been around for a long time. He was part of that new Hollywood crowd. So when you talk mm-hmm. about this transition of things that are happening in the late 60s, early 70s with Spielberg and De Palma and George Lucas all coming on the scene, Peter Bogdanovich was one of those people. Now, the really cool, interesting thing that I find among all of his films that he's done, now, his first movie that he did was The Last Picture Show, which I believe was also a black and white film. And then his second film was Paper Moon, 1973, mm-hmm. which was black and white as well.
I think he did What's Up, Doc? In between.
Yeah, that would be 72, right. But the interesting thing is that he became really, really, really good friends with Orson Welles in Welles' latter part of his life, and actually wrote one of the biographies of Orson Welles. And one of the influences of why he did Last Picture Show and Paper Moon in black and white was because Orson Welles says nothing is better than a movie shot in black and white. And so that's why he went and did these two uh-huh. in black and white instead of color. The other reason, too, is that both Ryan and Tatum O'Neill have very blonde hair at the time. And they were worried that if they did that in color, that the blonde hair would be look really odd for Dust Bowl.
Yeah.
It'd look really odd for Dust Bowl people, for mm-hmm. people that are trying to scrounge for a living. People thought that they wouldn't look dirty enough. But in the black and white film, their hair looks kind of brownish in some angles and lighter in other areas. So it has this dusty kind of look to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, speaking of the looks of our two main actors, they are related. It is mm-hmm. a father and daughter duo. I mean, that just seems like one hard. Like, did he think it lent more to them being playing off that they're actually not related? They are related. How do you think that kind of came across on the screen, just their dynamic together?
Well, so, I mean, that brings up one of the core questions, I think, for this movie is this movie opens up with a scam artist who is going around selling Bibles,
mm-hmm.
Cheap Bibles at a hugely inflated prices to old widows.
Right.
And he's making his living doing that, going from small Kansas town to small Kansas town, working for the Kansas Bible Company. And he happens to show up at this funeral for this woman, and he meets the daughter, Addie Prey. And people are like, oh, so is this your daughter? You two kind of look alike.
Right.
And he's like, no, this is not my daughter. I just know the mother and I kind of feel bad. And then they're like, oh, well, she has relatives in St. Joseph, Missouri. Why don't you take her with you since you're going that way? And then that's how they get hooked up. They do form a bond And I do think that the fact that they were father-daughter did help that, because Tatum O'Neill, I believe when this movie started filming, she was 8.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time the Oscars rolled around and she won, she was 10. So I think that that helps to have that fatherly figure there with her. But I guess the question for you guys is, by the end of the movie, do you think that Ryan O'Neill's character is actually Addie's real father in the movie?
Oh, yeah. I from the very beginning, I think that that's the obvious underpinning of this. He's such an inveterate liar that he can't even tell her the truth, that he knows that this is his daughter. I mean, and I think that the fact that they cast an actual father and daughter really makes that subtextual in every single frickin' scene, because people talk about, oh, you have the same jaw. These are people who are genetically related. You can see it on the screen. And I don't know that you would have been able to do, even the best casting agent might not have been able to get something that had that perfect resemblance to where you can go, yeah, this is her dad, guys.
Well, and part of that was Bogdanovich really wanted Tatum O'Neill for the piece, but her dad was like, no, she's too young to be getting into this business, et cetera, et cetera. And so he said, well, maybe if you played the father, you would be able to oversee this during the production and you'd be there keeping an eye on her. And so that's how he eventually agreed to play the part. But what do you think, Rodrigo? Do you think by the end of the movie that, these two are related in the movie?
Well, I think it doesn't completely matter. I like that the movie never explicitly says so, right? Mm-hmm. It lets you draw that conclusion either way, right? Either they're clearly related or they're not, but it doesn't matter because now they basically are father and daughter by the end of the movie, right? They don't want to be apart. So personally, I'm with Matthew. I think the movie does everything but tell you outright that it is in fact true. But it's, you know, they leave it open because I think they want you to take that step on your own, right? Mm-hmm. They want you to rather than tell you, oh, this is why these two characters should care for each other, they show you why they care for each other, mm-hmm. and then you can take that final step yourself.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think Rodrigo has the main point, is that it doesn't matter, ultimately, if these two are father and daughter inside the film, because the important part of Paper Moon is watching their relationship develop from total strangers to leaving an actual family member to run down a dusty road, to jump in an old busted up with a con man to continue the journey because it's the person you actually want to be with.
Right, right.
There are two other pretty big characters that hop into the storyline midway through the film in the form of a burlesque-ish dancer and
Lily von Stupp.
The girl.
No, Trixie Delight.
Who's kind of gone and decided that it's better to potentially not make any money following this girl around than be with her family through the hard times that everyone has fallen in. Did you think it was necessary to bring in these other characters to continue to develop the relationship?
Yeah, because at some point they're getting along so well. They're making so much money off this scam. And what really makes this team work is the fact that Addie can kind of read these old widows and know how much she can push that Bible sales. Because he's, you know, Ryan O'Neill's character has just been, you know, a set price, $10 or whatever it is. So his profit margin is not very good. But Addie can see, oh, here's somebody that is a little more rich. We could charge $25 for her and maybe give it to free for this other person or, you know, however it works out. And so that what makes their relationship really great, to the point that they're loaded. I mean, he has already made the money, the $200 that he owes her back and more. And so you have to introduce this conflict. Mm-hmm. And knowing that he is someone who may not be great with money and is always running around with different women, as is set up in the movie multiple times, it makes sense then that Madeline Kahn's Trixie Delight and her sidekick end up going along for the ride and end up taking basically all their money.
Yeah, what do you think about it, Rodrigo?
So this movie is kind of an episodic movie, right? You kind of see these adventures that they're having throughout, and one of the main episodes is that time when two other people join the gang. Mm-hmm. And you get to see how the dynamic changes, and it doesn't change for the better, as far as definitely not as far as Addie's concerned. And so she kind of has to put that plan into effect to change it back.
Yeah, what do you think about the introduction of two other characters through this relationship, Matthew?
Well, I'm of two minds, because it is difficult in a modern context to look at the character of Imogene and not kind of have just a little bit of cringe at the way the character is portrayed. But I feel like the real thing that she brings to this, that character, what's her name? Trixie Delight. What she brings to this is not just conflict, but a clear, at least to me, a clear statement here that Addie is actually smarter than Mose. And Addie is not just better at reading these old ladies. She's actually better at the whole confidence game, to the point where she puts one over on her, not unquote, dad, to get rid of that extra character. And I think that's another point where, just like at the end, where we see her doing something probably foolish and unwise to stay with Mose. She does that earlier in the film when she tries to get rid of Trixie. And when she successfully gets rid of Trixie by playing a long game involving manipulating four or five full-grown adults who should know better and getting away with it all, and also giving Imogene a little money so maybe she can go home too. I mean, it's one of those things where the character is actually showing a lot of herself in that sequence, even though it does feel like there's a lot more Trixie necessarily than it needs.
Yeah.
I'm not going to complain about anything with Madeline Kahn, especially Madeline Kahn playing Dippy.
I think the other thing that's kind of important about having those two characters appear and then exit is that if before they appear, the movie would be very short because they're just making money and they're getting along and things are wonderful. After they have exited and they're broke, they start to resort to more desperate scams in order to make their money and to make it back quickly. And that's what gets them in trouble with the law when they are caught smuggling alcohol.
Sheriff Higgins comes after him.
Yeah. Deputy Harden and his identical twin brother, Jess Harden, played by John Hillerman of Magnum P.I. fame.
Yeah, that is ultimately one of the big conflicts that ends the dramatic cons that we've been watching through in the entirety of Paper Moon, of when Addie and Mose hatch a plan to take one over on a bootlegger by selling him his own whiskey back. And then they have to run from the law multiple times, trade cars, hop the river to Missouri, get beat up, and then finally just kind of call it quits for a little bit.
And don't forget having to wrestle Randy Quaid.
Oh, yeah. Randy Quaid shows up.
That was the weird thing that I was not expecting about this movie, was how many people I actually recognize. I think we finally watched enough movies through this podcast that at like the three of you did in the first half, you're like, oh, this person. I'm like, oh, I recognize these three people. And again, like last week when we watched Cowboys, we had a store clerk who was featured in Blazing Saddles.
Right.
And this, we get Burton Gilliam, who played Floyd the front desk clerk, who was in Blazing Saddles. And then the actress who played Trixie, also in Blazing Saddles, which was crazy. But then seeing Cousin Eddie show up towards the end and get his wrestling on was just a wonderful moment for me watching this.
Yeah. Well, you have to remember, this is way early in Randy Quaid's career. I mean, this is only his third movie. And again, he was in What's Up, Doc, also directed by Bogdanovich. There is that relationship there that says, hey, we need somebody that looks big and could probably play dumb and do some wrestling for a car. Let's pull in Randy Quaid. So, you know, this is one of those things where it does pay to be connected to people in order to get that recognition and maybe kickstart your career. I don't know, but I would say being in two of those movies, which were successes, probably a good thing for him.
Yeah. Was there anyone else in this movie that I might have recognized that we've seen pop up other places in film? Those were the only couple that
Noble Willingham was in this. I know him as the captain from Walker, Texas Ranger. Okay. He was in this very briefly. And of course, the guy who was the deputy, the dumb deputy, I can't remember what he was in, but I know I knew him from something.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of those, their faces, but I think you hit on the main ones, especially when you get into the guy at the front desk. What's his name?
Burton.
Yeah.
Classic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One that I had through watching Paper Moon, besides trying to pick out all the filming locations, was Addie too smart of a child to be pulling all this off? Did it seem like a regular amount of intellect to be seen by a 9-year-old being able to improve on these cons by apparently a seasoned con man?
Yeah, the there's this trope, right? This like precocious child, and people love it. Like, people absolutely love a child that is smarter than a child ought to be. And sometimes they really, really skirt the edge and sometimes just go right past it of like how smart a kid and how aware, sort of socially aware of these complex situations a child even could be. And I think people are very lenient of it because we just can't get enough of it. You know, it's like, it just like, and I mean, I'm not saying they're equal, but it's like anytime there's a movie and all of a sudden one of the main male characters ends up in drag, like people just find that hilarious, you know, and it's just like, it's just drag, man, but it doesn't matter. Anytime it happens, it's just uproarious. And this is another one of those like tried and true tropes. It works every time. People just absolutely love it. And they're willing to, like, people are just so willing to suspend their disbelief for a little tiny child that talks like an adult.
Unless his name's Cousin Oliver.
Yeah. Well, and Cousin Oliver was, you know, kind of an exception to the rule in that he was an addition to a long running ensemble cast. And that's kind of a different trope, trying to pull the same thing. But I agree with Rodrigo, and I didn't feel like it was really in any way a problem in this story, because as we see, all of the main characters are basically desperately trying to get by and doing whatever they do, whether that be, you know, being a corrupt sheriff or being a borderline prostitute slash dancer, or, you know, being a grifter and traveling from town to town and ripping off people whose husbands have just died. I never felt like what she got away with ever felt like it was way into the, you know, the Steve Urkel territory. It didn't ever feel like she was ready to build a time machine and make her evil twin. But I also feel like that's the strength of this movie, is not just that the character is the smartest character in the movie, but the actress is able to pull it off. I think with a lesser actress, you know, even with a like a Christy McNichol, you have no idea who that is, or like a Lindsay Lohan in a modern context, I don't think that it would have played as well. And I think that's part of what's unique about this film, is that it's believable because the actress makes it believable. She's good enough to pull off even the ridiculous stuff that she gets away with at the hotel.
Yeah, she's good enough. She's also the youngest, I think up until Haley Joel Osment, she was the youngest actress to win an Academy Award.
Yep.
So, which is impressive.
Yeah, very impressive.
Steven, the reason that Paper Moon made it on to the show mm-hmm. is because we went to the theater a couple weeks ago and watched right. Logan. And right. from that, there was a list of movies that have inspired Logan. And so we decided to take a look at them.
Mm-hmm.
What are the main aspects you feel that Paper Moon influenced Logan?
So here's a loner guy.
Yep.
Right. In the form of Mose, who really has little or no interest in kids, who's suddenly forced to deal with a kid who he kind of likes, is kind of his relation,
mm-hmm.
And is actually better than he is. And so when you look at what's going on in Paper Moon and you take those themes of the parental lineage and someone is replacing you and what does it mean to be family, that stuff is right in there with almost every frame of Logan.
Mm-hmm. And it's also a weird quasi road trip movie mm-hmm. that Logan mm-hmm. is as they travel north to, I think it was Paradise or the Canadian border.
Right.
In Paper Moon, we see Mose and Addie meander their way across Western Kansas and then finally decide, hey, we should probably like go to that place that we initially set out for.
The fabled land of St. Joseph, Missouri.
Yeah. No one should live in Missouri, by the way, but whatever. It's fine. Oh, but yeah, it was definitely clear to me how you could definitely take aspects of the relationship between Mose and Addie mm-hmm. and just transplant them right into Logan. I think especially, as you mentioned, the weird idea of they're related, maybe, kinda, who really knows if they knew about each other before right. the first frame of this film.
Right. Right.
Right. So the thing that really torqued me about Paper Moon
mm-hmm.
is a lot of towns got mentioned, but never Hayes.
Yeah, and
did not appreciate it.
Well, and we say that the movie was shot in Hayes. There's really, from everything that I can track down, there are only a couple of shots in this entire movie that are in Hayes. So
yeah.
There is the, they say 10th and Main, but I'm pretty sure that it is the George Phillips Hardware Store on 8th Street.
I think 10th and Main, because I saw that,
mm-hmm.
is, you know, Gela's.
Yeah.
And then there's that lot, and then there's that hardware store that's defunct. I'm guessing that's what they're talking about.
Maybe. I think it's the interior of the George Phillips Hardware Store back when it was still a hardware store that they used for that ribbon scene.
The one on 8th and Main?
Uh-huh.
Right in the corner?
Yeah. I think so.
Okay.
And then the couple of widow houses were shot in Hayes.
Yeah, that was my thought, where the shots in Hayes was the widow houses, but I only mm-hmm. thought that because of brick roads, because we have a lot of those. Yeah. But then I remembered most old towns yeah. have brick roads, so that didn't really help.
In my research, I did find an article as Lawrence Journal World again, and I'll okay. share an image that they had in an article from 2003 that said some various widow houses were used in Hayes. Everything else was shot in Gorham, which is a really tiny town between
super
Hayes
small.
And Russell.
Yeah.
You blink and you miss it. Buying the ticket, I mean, that's real obvious because it's written on the side of the
Gorham,
building.
Yeah.
And also yeah. The place where Mose goes to blackmail the guy to get the $200 initially mm-hmm. at that other place. That was in Gorham. That place is still standing. You can still go there and see that
is it
thing.
There? I was going to go today, but it was raining.
It was really raining, so I jumped onto. I went onto Google Maps.
Did you?
Sure enough, thanks to Street View, it is right there, and you can still see it.
Like the train depot, everything?
Not the train depot. I couldn't find that one.
That one's not.
But the other place find. Where he goes and he's
yeah,
where he's trying to get the $200
like the
out
co-op.
Of the game. That building is still standing.
Oh, yes.
And that's one of the reasons why they wanted to shoot in this area. Originally, they were going to shoot in, where was it? I want to say like Indiana or something like that. But then as the scouting location scout was out here doing stuff, they realized that things haven't changed since the 1930s. Things really haven't changed in 40 years. So you need minimal set dressing to make this look like it did in the 1920s and 30s. And so that's why they moved out here. And even today, like I said, you can go on to Google Earth and you can find that building. And save for it being, you know, a little bit more rusty, it is the exact same building. So a coat of paint
yeah.
and a sign, and there you have it.
Yeah, really, things hadn't changed between 1930 and 1973, and they haven't changed between 1973 and 2017. Yeah.
So then the other places that we were looking at were McCracken.
Yeah, McCracken.
Which was a lot of stuff was shot down there. The opening funeral scene was shot at a cemetery down there.
Wilson seemed to be used extensively, yeah. Which, again, is a very small town right off the interstate. That it probably just gets a lot of play because it's next to the interstate and it's next to a pretty popular lake out here.
Mm-hmm. And according to Matthew's remembrance of the map of the DC universe, also supposedly mm-hmm. where Smallville is located.
That is true.
Oh, is that the location?
Yep. 90 miles west of Salina is the way they described it, or the I-70 something something interchange. I'd have to look it up now because I'm old, but yes, Wilson is right about where it would be located mm-hmm. in the 1980 something version of the DC Atlas.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So yeah, we had McCracken where a lot of stuff was shot there. La Crosse, which is another place which is south of us.
Yeah.
So everything really is Hayes is your staging location for the film. It's where all your crew and your movie stars are going to be at. And then you're just going out to these places, either up and down I-183 mm-hmm. or east and west on I-70. And most of these locations are within 45 minutes of here. In fact, what I want to do, try to do this weekend, if I have time, I actually found the coordinates for the final shot of the film where they're running down the dirt road.
Is that just in Liebenthal?
No, that's up in Codell.
Oh, okay.
Which is just north here. That's why okay. I said, hey, what are you doing for lunch today? Yeah. Drive up to Codell and get that last shot. So I want to do that. And then I want to also go down to McCracken and get the shot of the cemetery, which is essentially the first shot of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And then do a first shot, last shot.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, 45 years later. So that'll be interesting because I know what cemetery it is. And I've got the coordinates and the directions on how to get to that location up in Codell,
nice.
Which is like even smaller than Gorham.
Oh yeah, no, and that was the hard thing of picking out all of the locations they filmed in is once you get into the country, throw a dart at Western Kansas and it probably looks exactly the yeah. same as where they filmed.
And yep. it's really crazy, like I said, that some of these locations still exist and there are people that have dedicated websites to tracking down the current locations of where scenes in this film were, and you would think that they'd be people from around here that are doing it. No, our historical societies could give a craps about preserving any kind of history about that.
Not film.
No. But no. You know, there's the hotel, one of the hotels that they stay at. That building is still there because mm-hmm. it's all limestone. One of the banks early on, the building is still there. Although, you know, the corner door entrance kind of thing has been taken down. So a lot of these buildings still exist and you can go there today and you can say, oh, yeah, I can totally see where this came from.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of excited about going and going to those two locations, do a first shot, last shot. So,
yeah, it's very exciting for me because really the only movie that gets touted about Hayes from the people that live is Dances with Wolves
was never shot here
and it just gets like we get like mentioned a couple times.
Yeah, in fact, if you go into IMDb you can see if you do a search for Hayes, Kansas, it will tell you all of the locations that Hayes, Kansas has appeared in movies.
Yeah,
and I'm trying to find it now. I can't find it. Well, that sucks. But it did list, I was looking at it just the other night. And it listed Dances with Wolves, Paper Moon, and like two other movies where Hayes is mentioned in the movie.
Ooh, yeah. Very nice. Was there anything that really stood out to you, Rodrigo, about the cinematography in Paper Moon?
One of the really strong aspects was the back and forth between the characters, right? You get a lot of shots of the two of them sitting side by side, but you also get a lot of shots of them kind of talking to each other. And the way those were shot, you know, it's not just like your standard shot, reverse shot. A lot of them seem to be directly to camera,
mm-hmm.
which is, it's an interesting choice. It's a choice that is strong in a comedy, definitely, which I would assume this would be largely classified as. So really that's what stood out to me were these shot reverse shots Which could have easily been like child is talking up at the adult is talking down to the child, but they really kind of show you that pretty much from the beginning, Moe's and Addie are equals in this partnership, right? He's not any better than her, even though he can like drive and people take him seriously. Like she is like in it from the beginning.
Uh-huh.
Like,
yeah, I think that's a good point. That their first real interaction inside that diner when mm-hmm. she's not eating her coney. Is a lot of the personalities are established right there. Where mm-hmm. Moe's is not very steadfast in what he wants Addie to do, and it's kind of a pushover mm-hmm. and will just essentially like yell and like throw his hat and stuff. And Addie is very hard-headed and wants her $200 and is not going to eat your stupid hot dog mm-hmm. and give me my money and who are you? But you're right, in the cinematography, she is shown like head on, not looked down upon at all. From that moment, really,
oh,
on.
Right.
You know,
yeah, he knows that he's not going to be able to con her,
like
or convince
push her over,
her or
no.
sweet talk her into anything.
No,
right.
When the movie first started, when they are at the cemetery for Addie's mom's funeral, the first couple of shots when Moe's pulls up, you have a pretty wide, I would say maybe like 24mm mm-hmm. Centered shot, and I mm-hmm. go, oh no. Is this early Wes Anderson? No. Steven's going to hate this.
No. So this movie, the director of cinematography was Laszlo Kovacs, mm-hmm. who we've seen before in a movie called Ghostbusters. Also, a movie that we've seen here is Easy Rider. He was the director of cinematography, director of photography for Easy Rider.
Really?
Yeah.
That is... When did Easy Rider come out? It was about 69. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Interesting. Did you see any similarities in the way he was using the camera between Easy Rider and this?
No,
at all, Matthew?
Not at all.
I don't think it was similarities specifically, but there's definitely something where if you look at the two of them and go, yeah, I can see that. I don't know, and again, I don't necessarily analyze shots to the level that Steven does either, but there's something tonal, almost primal, that I could say, yeah, I can see how these, they're different themes, they're different centuries in almost a different way. But yeah, I feel like I can see the similarity, or I can see something to where I would go, I am not surprised to find that Easy Rider had that same guy behind the camera.
It's a little surprising to me.
Nah.
One thing that's that I always like about the cinematography of this piece,
yeah,
is that it's really contrasty. It has this beautiful contrast to it, because in black and white you expect to see a little bit more of the gray tones, but here it's not a harsh contrast, but the skies seem a little darker than what you would normally think if you went outside right now and took a shot with black and white. And that again goes back to Orson Welles, who was like, not only do you need to shoot in black and white, but you need to use a red filter, because that's going to bring out, you know, it's going to shift everything. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to get more contrast, and the sky is going to look more blue, and the faces are going to pop more, and it's just going to look a lot more interesting. And that's the thing that I noticed in this film, is that, wow, just everything has this. It's black and white, but it doesn't feel black and white.
Mm hmm.
And yeah. And I just it brings a whole different feel to what people would typically think of a black and white film. Because if you compare like this to the opening of Wizard of Oz, for example, those two are mm-hmm. going to look totally different from one another. And it really, really works here.
Rodrigo, The Paper Moon came out in 1973, many, many years past the invention of colored film.
Mm.
In recent years, we've seen less than a handful of films come out on black and white. I'm thinking of like Nebraska was pretty recent, and then The Artist, and that was 2011.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Do you ever think there's going to be a time of this renaissance of black and white? Because we are at a weird time when you look at Mad Max and like, oh, everyone needs to see the black and white version. Or I think like Batman v Superman had a black and white.
Logan
and then like Logan
is going to get a black and white release too.
Do you think we're on the verge of a black and white renaissance, much like 3D had in its time?
Sure. It could happen. And all this stuff is cyclical. There was a big black and white thing going on in the 90s, you know. Because
of Kevin Smith, and film was cheaper.
Yep. Yeah.
Clerks.
You know, all those like that new generation of film school kids that eventually became the standard directors that we talk about now, they all had their black and white projects. And in the 90s, it meant something different than it did in the 70s. And it's going to mean something different than it does if it comes back. But black and white is always going to have that clout to it, right? It's like it has like a movie that's in black and white automatically is putting a bid in to be classic, mm-hmm. or serious, or to be taken seriously, even if it's a comedy, because it's such a strong choice, right? Even for people that don't, you know, a lot of people watch movies and they don't realize that literally everything you see on screen is a choice that someone made.
Right.
But even people that don't get that, I think they see a black and white movie and in like somewhere in the back of their head they realize that this is a big choice that somebody made to say something, mm-hmm. right? Even if they don't get what it is or whatever, even if they're just watching the movie for the enjoyment of it, which of course none of the four of us can even do anymore. But so this absolutely, I think. Is there going to be a big black and white renaissance? Who knows? But we're always going to see movies use that for a statement, or sometimes, you know, kind of for a cheap statement. It really doesn't take much for them to just take a movie and treat it through black and white. I mean, obviously, there's plenty of work that has to be done, but it's not going to be hugely expensive for them to turn Logan black and white, or mm-hmm. for them to turn, I don't know, Suicide Squad black and white.
There would Oscar, be a lot of work.
Please refer to it as the Oscar winning Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
No.
No, it is an official distinction now.
Yeah.
No.
Steven, would you recommend all the listeners to Zach on Film that they need to rent Paper Moon?
I would say, no, don't rent this movie. Oh. Go and buy this movie because it is so good. You can get this on iTunes and various places, including that Amazon link over at majorspoilers.com. A little bit comes back our way, didn't cost you anything extra. But seriously, this is a really good film. And, you know, at the end, even though it kind of has a downer ending where they've lost their fortune and Moses has been beat to a bloody pulp, mm-hmm. and they've lost their car and they're driving around in this 19 teens truck.
Yeah.
It still put a smile on my face. And as they're driving away in that last little bit, I'm like, I forgot how much this is such a darling little film that the next day I was like, I kind of want to watch this movie again, but I got other things that I need to do. And even the last week or so, 2 weeks, I guess, I've been sitting around going, I really should watch that movie again because it is that good. And it deserves all the kudos and the credit that it's been heaped upon it because it's fantastic.
What are your final thoughts about Paper Moon, Matthew?
There was, when I was younger, a thing that would show up on MTV once in a while. It was called Unplugged. And what would happen was people that you expected to be, you know, rock and rollers or pop stars or, you know, your basic four-dimensional goons would come in and they would play an acoustic guitar, or they'd have a quiet set where they'd sing a cappella or with a piano. And this is what, or this movie reminds me of that, because this is a time when they could have gone full color. Even in 1973, they could have gone tricks and bells and whistles and done all sorts of psychotic stuff to this movie. But instead, they made a small, really engaging, really entertaining film that basically features two actors playing off each other and maybe half a dozen other people of note throughout the whole movie. And it goes really quickly and it's really entertaining. And just that central relationship is so strong that, you know, they tried to make a TV series out of it. They're like, yeah, let's do this for half an hour every week on TV. And it failed miserably. But the point is, it was such a strong first impression from this film that they thought, let's put this on TV. Let's make this a thing. Let's make more of this because it's amazing. When it's really just kind of a nice, I don't want to use the term stripped down, but it's a movie that's deceptively simple. And I agree with Steven. I actually, for the first time ever in Zach on Film History, found it on my on-demand cable channels and watched it for free. And I was like, yes, this is why I pay $139 a month for all you idiot channels. But yeah, I will probably watch it again in the next few days.
Rodrigo, is Paper Moon the quintessential Kansas film people should watch?
Absolutely, I think. more so than Dances with Wolves, at least.
What about The Day After? That's pretty...
Oh, yeah.
Actually, The Day After may be the quintessential Kansas movie, but we'll say that Paper Moon is definitely the quintessential Kansas comedy. And it's got everything you'd want, not just in a film about Kansas, because it does. It features, you know, both the nice aspects, interesting aspects, historical aspects about Kansas with prohibition and everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything from like fancy hotels, like fancy old timey Western looking hotels, to like frightening hayseeds out in the country.
Yeah.
But also, it features a great relationship between two characters and two actors that really carry this film effortlessly, like beautifully. Like this film is absolutely delightful. Oh yeah, one last thing that it features, if you live in Kansas, why you should watch this movie is because there's a scene where they just list every town in central Kansas.
Wait, that's over by Lucas? We could go through Luray.
Except for the town that Steven and Zach live in.
Yeah.
Yep.
And the town that I used to live in.
Yep. But,
every other town.
To be fair, they do say thanks to at the end in the credits.
Yeah, they
don't mention the Gorhams or the McCrackens or any of that. They just say thank you to the people of Hays, Kansas and St. Joseph, Missouri.
In a crap town in Missouri.
Yeah.
But it's fine.
Do you know?
I've been to St. Joe, Missouri. It's not that bad.
No, I'm sure it's wonderful.
It is just, I don't think there are any houses. It's just grain elevators, but they do have a lot of.
One other thing, the reason why this movie is called Paper Moon is the book. It's based on a book, Addie Prey.
Oh, okay.
Right. And Bogdanovich was going through and had just thrown down a bunch of like random titles, including Paper Moon. I think it was mentioned in the book or something. Mm. Or no, he was listening to the music of the time period, came across the songs, and he wrote that down. And then again, he goes to Orson Welles, who's an uncredited consultant on this film.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes one look at the Paper Moon, and he basically says, "You can sell the movie alone on the title." And so he said, "You should just release the title instead of actually doing a movie," because he thought that was the greatest title ever. And so they had to include the shot of her getting her photograph taken to include
it's
that.
Great,
so that it was tied back into the. Into the
I figured
movie.
They weren't going to, because they play the song and there's like, okay,
right.
This is it. Like, this is all you need normally, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's tons of movies that are just the name of a title or the title of a song, and they just play it once in the movie and that's it. That's all you need. But the fact that they actually made it an important moment in the film involving a paper moon is actually really strong. Like, they managed to bring that around and actually make it an important aspect of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
$2.5 million budget, $13 million in profit.
Not bad.
I'd say that's a good one.
That's a pretty good.
Money.
That's 73 like, money. Yep.
That's $17 billion no, today.
It's pretty close. Probably more like making the movie for $25 million and having it make $130 million.
I mean, not chump change.
No, big question though, Zach.
Oh, yeah.
Did the wife watch this with you? Did you talk her into it? Because I was going to call you up after I watched it, but I knew you were traveling and doing all that. Because I was going to say, look. Your wife needs to watch this movie because even though it's black and white, she's going to love it in the end.
I think, okay, so first, no, she did not watch it with me. She wanted to catch up on Dancing with the Stars.
Oh my God.
But after watching it, I think I can make a big enough pitch to at least say this movie features Hays, and I won't tell her, no, it kind of really doesn't. That I can get her to watch it, even though it is black and white. And I think she could possibly enjoy this more than Citizen Kane or Metropolis.
Yeah. Just lie to her and tell her that her dad's store is one of the locations.
Oh, that'd be pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So Paper Moon, great little
Don't
film.
Lie to your
really, really enjoyed watching it. What is the next film we have up on our Logan
series? Sure, the next Logan film that is inspired by this, it is a Clint Eastwood film called The Gauntlet.
You know, you saying ugh does not fill me with a whole lot of confidence with this movie.
It's not a great film, but if you're trying to, we're being chased by horrible people throughout the entire piece. Eh, all right.
All right, well.
Some people really like it.
Super exciting episode next week on Zach on Film when we watch Clint Eastwood's The Gauntlet. If you want to psych yourself up for that, in the meantime, head over to majorspoilers.com where you can find this podcast posting page. Did I say that right? Yeah, sure. Yeah. I said that right. It's fine. Yeah. It's fine. It's fine. We're going to keep going. And you can give your comments on Paper Moon or anything we talked about this week. While there, you could also download one of the other great podcasts for Major Spoilers, including the Major Spoilers podcast, Top 5 Critical Hit, and so many more that you will enjoy as you just wait for a whole week for the next episode of Zach on Film to come out. But I promise you'll make it through. Steven already mentioned the Amazon link over Major Spoilers, but there is a Patreon you can sign up for.
That's right. Head over to patreon.com/majorspoilers. If you enjoy this show, you enjoy the conversation, you want to see us dive into even more movies going forward, then we need your support. As little as $2 a month, that's like nothing. Head over to patreon.com/majorspoilers. Sign up today. Support your favorite podcasters.
Yeah, just trick a little old lady giving you change and you can get $2 every month. It's fine. So that's it for this week's episode of Zach on Film. We'll see you next week.
This podcast is copyright 2017 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.